Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. And the title of today's forum is Israel-United States Relationships and the assessment and the future of those relationships. And today's guest is Dr. Khalil Shikaki. And Dr. Khalil Shikaki is the Wayne Owens Chair in Middle Eastern Studies. And the Wayne Owens Chair honors the late Wayne Owens, who represented the state of Utah in the House of Representatives from 1972 to 74, and again from 1986 to 1992. Mr. Owens received his law degree from the University of Utah, and he walked 711 miles through Utah to win the seat in 1972. And to continue that pace, he also voted to stop funding for the Vietnam War, to impeach Richard Nixon, and championed many environmental causes, compensation for downwinders, and peace in the Middle East. Wayne Owens also was born in 1937. He married the late Marlene Wessel in 1961, and together they raised five children and many grandchildren, some of whom are in the audience today. After leaving Congress, Wayne Owens co-founded and served for 10 years as president of the Center for Middle Eastern Peace and Economic Cooperations, and Representative Owens was inducted into the Hinckley Institute of Politics Hall of Fame on April 12, 2007. And a little bit about Dr. Khalil Shikaki. He finished his PhD in political science from Columbia University in 1985, and he has taught at several universities, including Al-Najah National University, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and the University of South Florida in Tampa. And he spent the summer of 2002 as a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C. Between 1998 and 1999, he jointly with Dr. Yazid Saig, Dr. Shikaki led a group of more than 25 Palestinian and foreign experts on Palestinian institution building. And since 2007, Dr. Shikaki has directed a team of Arab scholars and experts working under the auspices of the Arab Reform Initiative to produce an annual report of the Arab transition to democracy. And he has written op-ed articles in American, Arab, European, and Asian newspapers, including some of the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, and New York Times. Please join with me in welcoming our guest, Dr. Khalil Shikaki.
Thank you very much. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for coming this morning. My talk is about where things are, where things stand today on Palestinian-Israeli relations. It's actually a good time to talk about this topic because three important elections are about to take place that will probably have some impact. I can't be certain that they will have an impact, but they will probably have some impact on what I have to say. American elections will certainly create hopes or dash hopes for quick resumption of negotiations. There's an Israeli elections in January, just 2 days after the inauguration of the new president. There will be elections in Israel. And although the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, at this point seemed to be the next prime minister, nothing is certain. There are a lot of things that are happening in Israel, today, and things might actually be different than what we expect, what public opinion surveys are showing at the moment. So we might be surprised. In a week or so, we will have Palestinian local elections. They are not as consequential as the American and Israeli elections, but they will have some impact. Although Hamas is not participating in those elections, nonetheless, they represent some political revival in the West Bank. They might also give the Palestinian Authority some legitimacy. Might not, who knows? We'll have to wait until we see the outcome of the elections and, more importantly, the rate of participation, given the Hamas boycott of these elections. The rate of participation might actually be the most important indicator of where things are heading. So what is it that I want to talk about this morning? There are four things that I intend to cover. Number one is to say something about current and possible outcomes of Palestinian-Israeli relations. A lot of my talk is going to focus on the current relationship and the basic or core elements of this relationship at this point, the most important processes that are going on. I will then outline four other possible outcomes for this relationship in the coming year or two. Although I'll speculate about 5 years down the road and what might happen, for the most part, I'll be happy if I just give you my speculation about what might care, how the next year or two might affect the current status quo and the current core processes of this status quo. My second topic will be on the drivers. What are the drivers of the status quo, current status quo, as well as the possible other outcomes? I'll focus on three particular drivers, including the international regional environment, the U.S., the Arab Spring, and so on, as well as the Israeli elections, but also internal Palestinian dynamics, domestic politics, most significantly the divisions that exist within the Palestinian Authority, most prominently the Fatah and Hamas split. My third topic will be to describe the dynamics that are currently behind the basic elements of the status quo. And finally, I'll make a few conclusions about the future. So let me start by outlining the five possible outcomes, starting with the status quo. The status quo is, to a large extent, the product of three processes that are underway. One process is the reality in the West Bank, where Palestinians and Israelis are not negotiating. For the past 4 years, there has been no attempt, serious attempt, to negotiate. There has been a meeting or two between the Palestinian president and the Israeli prime minister, but these were a waste of time for the most part. Nothing came out of them. In fact, if anything came out of those, it was the conclusion on the part, at least of the Palestinian side, that negotiations with the current Israeli government is pointless. And this certainly contributed to the continued stalemate and the refusal of the Palestinian Authority to return to negotiations. The second element The first element, as I said, is a stalemate. This stalemate in the West Bank provides conditions for what, just for the sake of argument, for now I will call the one-state reality. This one-state reality is a situation where Palestinians who live in the West Bank are essentially governed by the Palestinian Authority, but they do come under the control of the Israeli government as well, the Israeli military government in the West Bank in particular. Israel, therefore, Palestinian lives are affected by what Israel decides. Palestinians, on the other hand, have very little influence over how decisions are made. Those decisions, as I said, that affect their lives. Israel also builds settlements in the West Bank. These settlements take up a lot of Palestinian land. Steps that the Israelis put in place in the West Bank create public impression that occupation is here to stay. It's not about to end anytime soon. That the two-state solution is no longer viable or practical. And that the future is uncertain. For settlers who live in the West Bank, this is considered good news that the Palestinians, at least. In fact, this is also true of the Israeli public as well, are concluding that the two-state solution is no longer viable. In fact, this is indeed a tremendous victory for the settlement movement. Part of its aim was always to prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, along with this one-state reality, two things are happening, one in Gaza and one in the West Bank. In Gaza, there is a significant effort underway to transform the Gaza Strip under the Hamas government into a de facto state. Statehood for Gaza, therefore, is becoming a major political drive. The consequences of this, of course, is that West Bank become the territorial integrity of the West Bank and Gaza is questioned. And the whole idea of a two-state solution might also be revised if and when this, the Gaza state, might become a reality. It's highly unlikely that in the next 2 or 3 years this will become a real state. But it could become a de facto mini-state. I'll say under what conditions this could become a reality in a minute. The third process that is underway is in the West Bank, and that is the PA is becoming weaker and weaker. And although I do not expect the PA to collapse anytime soon or to dissolve itself anytime soon, we might find ourselves at the end of the period I'm looking at, the next year or two, without the PA, for various reasons. I'll also discuss some of those. Okay, so these are the three basic elements of the status quo. They will continue to remain with us for the next 2 years or so. There are four other if we continue with the current situation, the one-state reality unfolding, Hamas's attempt to transform Gaza into a de facto state, and the continued weakening decline of the PA, if this continues, let's call this a drift outcome. We are drifting. We, meaning Israelis and Palestinians, would continue to drift, not knowing exactly where we're heading. All three processes would continue to move forward. Ultimately, they will destroy the two-state paradigm, and it will be extremely difficult a few years down the road to reverse this process. However, since I'm a little bit optimistic this morning, I'll start with two positive outcomes that could change this status quo. There are two possibilities here. One is not really all that positive, but I'll say it's positive for now. And that is, we move away a little bit from the status quo. Let's call this a move to the right. And we start negotiations. So along with these three elements in place that are described in the status quo, we might start certain negotiations meaning somehow we do manage to get back to the table. How? American pressure might be one way. You know, the Palestinian Authority depends greatly on financial support, financial and political support from Washington. Washington has been trying to exercise a lot of pressure on the PA, sometimes effectively, sometimes with little effect. It's possible that some of this pressure after the American elections might actually produce on the Palestinian side a move to return to negotiations. Most Palestinians, if the only new input is simply American pressure after the elections, most Palestinians will think this is just a waste of time. But the PA leadership will probably do it nonetheless because of other interests, financial and political, even though knowing that this would be a waste of time. The PA might also be trying to abort some worse outcomes by returning to negotiations. It might think it is aborting them, such as what? Such as the collapse of the Palestinian Authority. One of the features of the current PA weakening is the financial crisis. The PA is today in its worst financial crisis since its establishment. It hasn't yet paid salaries the last month, and for the past 3 months, it really hasn't been able to pay much salaries. It has been borrowing extensively from local banks. It has been buying extensively from local producers, but it has been able to pay almost nothing for them for the past 12 months at least. So the Palestinian Authority faces a tremendous challenge on this front. And if Congress blocks money, and if Israel is to do something similar, this could speed up things and bring about the collapse of the PA. And this is not in the interest of the Palestinians or Israelis. Well, that's my view, of course. Or the Americans. And therefore, the PA might decide, well, if all it takes for the PA to survive is to return to negotiations, why not? There might be certain domestic consequences for such a decision, but the PA might nonetheless take such a risk at one point, knowing again that these negotiations would be pointless, that there is really no point in returning to negotiations that would have to start from scratch. That is, these would be negotiations with the current Israeli government after it has been re-elected in January. Assuming that this is the scenario that we are contemplating for now. Okay. That's one possible outcome, that along with the three processes I described in the status quo, we might somehow return to negotiations, and these negotiations might continue for the next year or two. after that, without an end. Nothing really important, therefore, would happen, and the three elements I described would still be with us 2 or 3 years down the road, and in fact, in a worse shape than they are now. Okay. I'll be a little bit more optimistic than this and say, okay, in January, February, perhaps March, after everyone has been re-elected or elected or a new government is in place, there is a return to negotiations. But this time, it's actually more serious than my second outcome. How could this be more serious? If the parties return to the table with a set, with an agreed set of ideas, principles, terms of reference, whatever you want to call them, there is that possibility that if these sets of principles or set of principles, if this is real and it is indeed substantive, there is a possibility, therefore, that things could change. This is the rosiest of all scenarios. Let me give you an example of how rosy this picture can be. By the time I'll finish, I will take you away from this rosy scenario, I promise. But for now, let me give you a rosy scenario. On the American side, Obama gets reelected. Sorry for those who would like to see Romney getting reelected. I know some of my friends work for Romney, but I don't think Romney will have a role in this scenario of mine. The rosy scenario, I'll have a role for Romney in some other scenarios, but not in this one. In this one, I see Obama getting reelected. And I see Obama showing more guts than he did in his first term. Guts meaning he is willing to use leverage not only against the Palestinians, but the Israelis. Unlikely, I know. But for the time being, let's assume that this is to happen. He would use leverage. And he would put forward a set of ideas. He started to do this, actually, so it's not far-fetched. Last May, he presented some ideas. He talked about borders and security and so on. So he could begin his new term putting out a set of principles, terms of reference, he might call them, and he might say to the two sides, come to the table if you agree with them. Now, if the parties do come to the table agreeing to those terms of reference, I think we can expect the basic elements of the status quo that I described to begin to unravel in a serious manner. Now, what would make this process of unraveling really serious? Well, if the change is not just in Washington, if it is also on the Palestinian and Israeli sides, let me give you an example of how things could be serious on the Israeli side. Well, if the center in Israel is to revive itself, and this is not, it's not impossible. Again, remember, we are in the rosy scenario. So we can imagine Ehud Olmert returning to politics. His wife probably will hate him for it. She would be right for hate him for it. But he is under tremendous pressure to return. I'll give you one element of the pressure. A survey just a few days ago showed that if he is to return and lead a center party, he wins. He gets 31 seats. Likud gets 27. This center party would include, in addition to Olmert, Livni would join him. And she would. Actually, if he does return, Livni would probably join him. Mufaz would work under him. Yes. Labid is his friend. He would, you know, Yair Labid. He has formed recently a political party called Yesh. There is a future. There is a future is a party that is expected now to win up to 15 seats in the next Israeli elections. A combination of Labid, Livni, Olmert could actually bring the center back to become a real competitor to the Likud. One other person, again, this is a rosy scenario, I must remind you, Aryeh Deri. Aryeh Deri has returned. He will probably lead Shas. This is not to say that he will be able to do whatever he wants to do. He's more on the moderate side. Shas is not a moderate political party. Most of Shas's voters are hawkish people. They're hardline. They don't like Palestinians much. They don't like compromise either. But Deri does. Deri is actually a person who could very well work with the Palestinians. And he supports the two-state solution. This morning, surveys in Israel show that if he leads, take away from Eli Yishai, who is currently the head of Shas, his party could win 4 more seats in the next Israeli elections. If you are Ovadia, you're safe, and you hear the good news. If you have any hesitation about Deri leading, becoming the chairman of the Shas party, you would put them aside. If Ovadia Yosef decides, you know who Ovadia Yosef, right? No? He's a spiritual leader of Shas. He is spiritual. He's everything in Shas. Whatever he decides goes. If Ovadia Yosef decides not to appoint him, and that's what it is. There is no elections in Shas. And Ovadia Yosef decides, and if he decides not to appoint him chairman, and Deri decides to run on his own, he could, on his own, have 6 or 7 seats. That's again today's this morning. Now, where would these seats come from? Who would lose if Shas gets additional seats? Not center left. Right will lose. The seats would actually come from the Likud. That's bad news for Netanyahu. Okay, once again, we are still in the rosy scenario. Let me make it even rosier for you. Let's say that you are Olmert, and you decide you want to return, and you really want to make a revolution. One way of making a revolution and really, really sort of change things for you in the elections is to secretly meet with Abu Mazen, agree on the set of principles for a permanent status agreement. Don't wait for Obama to get reelected or anything. Do it now. Keep it a secret. But leak the news that a deal has been made. Set, agreed, sealed. Let the Americans know about it. If the Americans confirm the story, wow. The Israeli public is told a permanent status agreement has been reached. No one can leak the details. because Olmert is not entitled to negotiate on behalf of Israel. If details are leaked, he will actually lose, not win. But this is, again, my way of making this scenario as rosy as it can get. So if any of these things is to happen, and we find ourselves in the next few months in serious negotiations, then the status quo that I described earlier will begin to unravel. I haven't actually described the status quo yet in as much details as I want to, but I will. Okay, so I was moving on the right. Say the status quo is somewhere in the center. I moved one step by just returning to elections, to negotiations. Not meaningful negotiations, but negotiations nonetheless. And then I moved to meaningful negotiations. So that's also, it's not a simple step. This is a jump, but it's a good jump. It takes us really into serious business of peacemaking. An Israeli-Palestinian relationship would dramatically be altered. Okay, let me now go to the left. Sorry for those on the left. I'm associating the left with bad news. It's not intended. It's just the caffeine this morning. Two things could happen on the left. One is that we find ourselves, Israelis and Palestinians, in a confrontation. What kind of confrontation? Well, mostly nonviolent, mostly diplomatic, but it might also have some popular dimensions to it. Diplomatic, we go to the UN, we fight the Israelis at the UN, we might then sometime in the next few months, maybe sooner than later, we might get a title. Instead of having us at the UN called the PLO mission, observer mission, we might be called a State of Palestine observer mission. It's just a change in the name. But if we want, and we, the Palestinians, take this seriously, and we might, in this scenario of mine, this outcome, I would describe two to the right. This is the third one. This one is on the left of the status quo. What we do here is that we decide to really make things hot for the Israelis by going to the International Criminal Court as a state. The International Criminal Court so far has declined our application for membership so that we would sign internet agreements that would allow us to become a signatory to the convention related to the International Criminal Court. If the International Criminal Court and says, okay, so now that the General Assembly has recognized you as a state, we have no alternative but to accept you, we might then begin to take the Israelis to this court as war criminals. We can take the Israeli prime minister, chief of staff, anyone we want. We might not. This is diplomatic warfare. Things could go nasty, but not really very, very nasty. Most likely, we will come under tremendous pressure from the Americans and the Europeans, who will say, don't do that, please. You cannot turn this relationship into such a diplomatic war. We might listen, we might not, but if we don't go to the International Criminal Court, we might make things difficult for the Israelis at home by mobilizing public agitation against the Israelis non-violently. So there might be some popular confrontations. Now, in this scenario, these things do not really, really make much of a difference. This outcome will not alter in any significant way any of the three core elements of the Sarska, it will complicate matters, but it will not alter any in any significant way the basic core elements of the Sarska. What would do that? What would alter the elements of the status quo? A fifth possible outcome. Fifth. That's far left. Sorry again for the far left. Violence. The whole thing burst into violence. We might actually start with our outcome four, find ourselves losing control over things, and all of a sudden, we are in five. Outcome five, there's a lot of violence. We go back to the Intifada or something similar to that. That would certainly begin to change things and change things dramatically. It could change things both for the Palestinian Authority and for the Israeli occupation. Okay, I'm not going to speculate now in what direction this could be. Actually, we don't know. It's always amazing what violence does. And one of the things it does, it simply prevents us, destroys our ability to predict the future because it's so unpredictable. Okay, so these are the five possible outcomes. Continuation of the status quo with its three main elements. Some negotiations on the right, maybe some confrontation on the left. Or we might actually change things considerably by going to the extremes, the rosiest of all the scenarios and the bloodiest of all the scenarios. What would drive any of this? What would make things move forward? What would make things change or move quickly than they are moving now? I said there are three drivers. I'll start with one. I've already mentioned the Americans. The Americans might change things. If the Obama administration decides to return to the negotiating table with a set of terms of reference, it might also stop funding of the Palestinian Authority. That could also make a difference. They can deliberately bring down the Palestinian Authority by stopping to fund it. Or they can make the two-state solution a lot more viable than it is today by using leverage against both sides, forcing them to come to the table with an agreed set of terms of reference. But we don't have to go far. Look at our own region. Look at what the Arab Spring had done. Egypt can make a difference. How? Well, Hamas has asked Egypt to establish a free trade zone along its borders with Gaza. If Egypt says yes, so far Egypt has neither said yes nor no. Egypt finds itself in a difficult position. If it said yes, this would mean recognition of the legitimate government of Hamas in Gaza, and it would mean delinking Gaza from the West Bank, severing all links between Gaza and Israel, and by extension, the West Bank. This is what Hamas wants to do now. Hamas has essentially outlined a concept that is trying to sell to the Egyptians, whereby the government in Gaza severs all links with Israel. So it won't get any water, electricity, trade, nothing, absolutely nothing from Israel. It blocks the crossings through Israel, and the borders is fully open with Egypt for trade and passengers and so on. It's a full transformation, but it would mean two things for the Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority in particular. One is that Gaza is no longer part of what is now the custom union between Israel on the one hand and the Palestinians, both West Bank and Gaza. And it would mean that the government in the West Bank under Fayyad and Abbas is no longer the only legitimate government for the Palestinians, Hamas and its government. Well, that's the first step to make Gaza a de facto state. Other countries might do the same. The Qataris are already doing it. There is a mission, a Qatari mission in Gaza today. The Qataris have committed themselves to spend $450 million in the next 3 years rebuilding Gaza. And they have a mission, an ambassador in Gaza to do that. And there are rumors, it's not clear how credible they are, but they have not been denied yet by the Qataris, that the Emir of Qatar and his wife are about to visit Gaza. Jordan could make a difference. Again, we're talking about the outcome of the Arab Spring. The change in Egypt makes this idea of a Gaza statehood real. Without it, there would be no... The whole idea would not be feasible. Hamas would not be contemplating such idea without the Arab Spring, without the Islamists winning in Egypt. The previous government in Egypt considered Hamas a threat, considered a state in Gaza a strategic nightmare. Well, the change in Egypt has essentially transformed these two ideas. Hamas is no longer a threat, it's a friend, a sister, Islamist movement. And a Gaza state in Gaza might not be such a bad idea because the tunnels under Gaza are causing Egypt a lot of security threats. And Egypt is seriously contemplating blocking them, closing them. They really cannot do that without Hamas's assistance. There's no way that Egypt can block all the tunnels. And Hamas will not assist without Egypt agreeing to a free trade zone along the borders with Egypt. So trade, instead of being underground, would become above ground. But the political ramifications are tremendous. Egypt could, without necessarily embracing the positions of the previous Egyptian government, Egypt could continue to seek reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas and seek the reunification of the West Bank and Gaza. That's one step Egypt can take. And if Egypt decides to do it, really do it, and pressure Hamas to go along, there might be a change. Okay, I'm dwelling on Egypt. I'm not going to do this for everything that I have to say, but because Egypt is really important for one of the core elements of the status quo, it's important to remember. There could be some other things that could be as important. Let's talk about Jordan. If things go bad in Jordan, again, it's an Arab Spring issue. If things go bad in Jordan, and we have another right-wing coalition in Israel in a few months, and things really, really go bad in Jordan, I mean really bad, then the idea of Jordan is Palestine will be back. If Jordan is Palestine is back, and the Israeli right-wing finds an opportunity, then the one-state reality, again, one of the core elements of the status quo, that one-state reality will gain tremendous power. Nonviolence. The Arab Spring brought about a lot of the concept that nonviolence is effective. Palestinians in the past never really believed in nonviolence. First Intifada was considered a success. But most Palestinians really didn't think about the outcome of the First Intifada as a great success. Oslo was not seen as a great success. There was a time when Palestinians did consider it a great success, but not anymore. And for a long time, every time we asked in surveys among Palestinians about nonviolence, is nonviolence effective, would the Israelis change their mind if there is Palestinian nonviolent activities going on? Most Palestinians said no. The Israelis understand nothing but the language of force. Only force would change things for the Israelis. Nonviolence doesn't work. Now we actually have a majority of Palestinians who say, yeah, nonviolence is good. It could change things. And in fact, not only that, when asked Palestinians, would you participate in nonviolent activities that would block roads, break through checkpoints, roads of settlers, an army, I mean, a majority of Palestinians say yes. In fact, over the past 12 months or so, we have seen an increase in the willingness of the Palestinians to participate in such activities. Mid-year last year, it was about 50% who said yes, they would participate. Now, in our most recent survey last September, 60% said they would participate in such activities, and 60% say such activities would indeed change things for Israelis and Palestinians alike, helping to end Israeli occupation. Palestinians, before you jump to any conclusions, are not participating in nonviolent activities today. There's some minor activities that are going on, and there are probably more Israelis than Palestinians participating in them. But the idea itself, an outcome of the Arab Spring, is actually gaining grounds. If and when groups other than Fatah and Hamas decide that they had enough of Fatah and Hamas and they want to mobilize the public on their own and so on, it will take them some time, it will take some organization and so on, and it will probably require a lot of shock treatment and so on. We might see this happening. So nonviolence seemed to have left an impact. The Arab Spring has also contributed. Remember what I said about the weakening of the Palestinian Authority as one of the core elements of the status quo. One reason for the weakening is because the Palestinian Authority is not getting money. Part of it has to do with economics and economic life and the international economic and financial crisis. We, the Palestinians, are not producing as much as we used to. Our own economic activities are not as great as they were. Between 2008 and 2010, we had annual 9% growth. Now, in 2011, 2012, the growth is 5 to 4%. And this means money, and this was not anticipated in 2011 or 12. Our own economic performance is much lower than we anticipated in our budgets. And so we're collecting less money than we anticipated, which means we have less money to spend, which means we're not able to pay salaries. But another reason that is not related to the international economic crisis, but more related to the Arab Spring, is that Arab countries are simply preoccupied with their own problems and not paying the Palestinian Authority much. They're making a lot of promises, but they're not delivering. So donors are not coming up with the money. Congress is blocking some of the money. And Europeans are basically saying, well, Palestinian Authority is not negotiating. The two-state solution is threatened. For how long can we continue to subsidize this process? We're not going to increase our financial assistance to the Palestinian Authority until we know where this authority is heading. Is it going to collapse? Is it going to the UN to complain and wage diplomatic warfare, or is it going to negotiate? In these conditions, we're not going to make any far-reaching financial commitments. So the PA, because of this marginalization of the Palestinian question and the preoccupation of Arab countries with their own problems and so on, this is weakening the PA further. Okay, so I think this is enough for the regional international element. I've just giving you a taste of how these international regional developments are impacting the status quo. The change in Israel. Well, I've already spoken about that. So let's not dwell on this. If you think things will change, if you think the idea of a center-left government in Israel is feasible, then that would certainly have significant impact on the three core elements of the status quo. If, on the other hand, you think the future is going to be the same as what we have now, if you think Netanyahu will get reelected, Likud will be the largest political faction, it will form a right-wing coalition, even if it includes some of the center and left, smaller center and left parties, that isn't really going to make much of a difference. The status quo will be consolidated. What we see now is what we will see in the future. Okay, so what about domestic developments? That's my third driver. Domestic developments could make a difference. What is the most important domestic development that is impacting on the status quo? Well, obviously, the most one is the split. The most important one is the split between Fatah and Hamas. If reconciliation efforts succeed, man, it's a big if. If you ask me now, what are the chances for reconciliation? Well, actually, I'll answer this in a minute. But for now, the quick answer is not much. There isn't likely to be any reconciliation anytime soon. But the question of reconciliation is extremely important, not only because of Gaza, West Bank, unity or lack of it, but because of other issues related very much, and thereby the issue of Gaza statehood. But more as importantly, the survival of the Palestinian Authority depends in part on its own legitimacy in the eyes of its own public. And without reconciliation, if you ask me, what are the chances that the Palestinians will have presidential and parliamentary elections in the next year or two in the absence of reconciliation? I would say zero. So how can the PIA survive if it has no legitimacy? Hardly. It will continue to weaken. So domestic developments, particularly those related to the basic divisions in society, Fatah, Hamas, the chances of reconciliation, thereby the chances for elections and so on, can all have significant impact on the core elements of the status quo. Okay, you're now fed up with the core elements of the status quo. What is driving these core elements of the status quo? Well, I'll give you five dynamics for each. Why am I dwelling on it? Well, because these are the things that are going to stay with us for some time to come, probably for the next 5 years, barring the two extremes. The two extremes, the rosiest of all scenarios and the bloodiest of all scenarios. Barring these two, these core elements are here to stay for some time to come, and they will coexist together. Let's take one of those. The Gaza state. Hamas, let's look at the drivers, the driving dynamics for this. Hamas has done a great deal of institutionalization for its government in Gaza. It distrusts Fatah immensely. That's an impediment to reconciliation. Hamas does not see a Palestinian elections, parliamentary and presidential, as being meaningful. In what sense? Well, when Fatah and the Palestinian president says to Hamas, let's go to negotiate, let's go to elections. That's how we unify the West Bank and Gaza. Hamas says, well, what if we win the elections? What happens? He says, you govern. You become the rulers of the West Bank and Gaza. They say, how? The Israelis will arrest our members of parliament, and if our president comes from the West Bank, he or she will also be arrested. Is Israel going to allow us to have control over the institutions of the West Bank? Of course not. The security services in the West Bank? Of course not. At best, if we win the next elections, we continue to control Gaza. So elections are not really meaningful because we already control Gaza. We don't need to control Gaza in elections, through elections. But if we lose elections, we lose Gaza. So these elections are good for you because if you lose them, nothing changes for you. But if you win them, then you take over Gaza. And we lose. And you do whatever you want to do, and we don't like what you intend to do. So elections are not really meaningful, and they cannot be the cornerstone of reconciliation. Find something else for reconciliation, to kickstart reconciliation. Hamas also says, why do you want to reunify the West Bank and Gaza to begin with? You guys, you nationalists, you Fatah, you Abbas, want to negotiate with Israel, right? You want a state, a Palestinian state? Go negotiate with Israel. We know that this state will have extreme limits in its sovereignty. Let that apply to the West Bank. Don't bring these constraints on sovereignty to Gaza. We're now free. We have no Israeli occupation. We can have a state of our own that has absolutely zero treaty-based constraints on its sovereignty. Why do we want to link up with you guys in the West Bank, reach an agreement with Israel that takes away sovereignty from us? It's not good for the national interest. So Hamas basically says reconciliation. Well, publicly Hamas doesn't say any of what I've just said, by the way. Hamas publicly says reconciliation is great, elections is great, unification is great, we want it, and we want it now. We will never be the impediment to reconciliation or reunification, absolutely out of the question. But it lies. Okay, so this is one dynamic that pushes for Gaza state. Another dynamic, the Israeli siege. How is that a dynamic? Well, as long as the Israelis say we'll give Gaza only a limited amount of gasoline, a limited amount of electricity, we will allow the movement of goods only from outside into Gaza, but we will allow nothing or almost nothing from Gaza to outside. So no export from Gaza. As long as Israel keeps doing these things, Hamas says, you see, this situation is untenable. We cannot continue to live under these conditions. We have to break away from Israel altogether, completely. And we have to open up to the rest of the world. And we can only do that through Egypt, so we have to do it. So the siege that Israel imposes over Gaza contributes to the Gaza statehood. Some Palestinians, some nationalists say, but that's exactly what Israel wants. Israel wants Gaza to break away and become independent on its own. A third dynamic, of course, is the rise of Islamism in the region. Hamas says, finally, Islam has arrived to the region, which means we now have friends in high places everywhere in the Arab and Muslim world. And if we have a state in Gaza, it will have a future because we have all these friends all over the place. They will support us financially, politically, open up markets for us, welcome us, recognize us as a legitimate government. So the rise of Islamism is contributing to the Gaza state dynamics. A fourth dynamic is money. Political economy. For those of you who are political economists, this is a great story. Let me give you an example, hopefully without spending too much time on it. Say you want to buy a car, and you live in Gaza. you can buy a car, it will come to the Ashdod port in Israel. In Ashdod, the Israelis will impose custom duties. These custom duties, technically and in theory, then are transferred to the Palestinian Authority, the one in the West Bank, under Fayyad. Things are not actually happening right now in exactly in this way, but they could, if the Israelis change their mind a little bit. Your car will also need gasoline. If the gasoline comes from Israel, then per liter, Israel imposes 4 shekels, $1, taxes per liter of gasoline. Where the money goes? To the PA in Ramallah, to Fayyad. Okay, so car and its gasoline. What if it comes from Egypt? If it comes from Egypt, Hamas imposes taxes on the car. Hamas imposes its own taxes on the gasoline. Actually, the gasoline story is fascinating because gasoline in Egypt is very cheap. Why is it cheap in Egypt? Because the government subsidizes it. And Gazans can actually get their hands on subsidized gasoline through the tunnels. And Hamas doesn't actually, currently, Hamas imports a great deal of this gasoline through the tunnels, and the Egyptians turn a blind eye to that. Last year, 2011, Hamas made 750 million shekels, that's almost $200 million, on taxes imposed on gasoline alone. Now, of course, if Israel is smart, it would allow all gasoline to come from the West Bank. Hamas would get none of this money. But Israel is not smart. It allows the gasoline to come through the tunnels. It allows cars do come through tunnels. Not enough for Gaza, but they actually have tunnels that allow cars to come in. Okay. Now imagine a situation whereby every trade Gaza has doesn't come through Israel, therefore taxes and custom duties are not sent to Ramallah, but is sent to Gaza and Hamas. Hamas becomes rich, and its government puts its hand on millions of dollars in taxes and revenues. Political economy indicates that Hamas has tremendous interest in making Gaza independent with absolutely zero links to Israel. The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has the exact opposite interest, a driver for Gaza statehood. Finally, public opinion. Now, public opinion says no to Gaza statehood. Public opinion considers national unity value number one. But when we ask Palestinians, okay, so under the present conditions, if the Israelis are to open the borders completely with Gaza and allow trade with Gaza and so on and movement, would this be a good thing to the extent that you would agree that the borders with Egypt should not be opened? Or would you instead want borders with Egypt to be opened with trade with Egypt only, so all links with Israel would be severed, as Hamas says it wants? A majority of 70% or more says yes. So public opinion does not associate the opening, the severing of links with Israel and the opening of links to Egypt with lack of national unity. That is something Hamas can build on. Okay, now I miscalculated my time, I must admit. And we are still in core item number one in the status quo. Okay. We'll get a chance to ask questions and get to the other issues. But let me just say very quickly a few things about the other two dynamics. The one-state reality. Where does the one-state reality... let me just be clear. From the outset, I do not believe the one-state reality can transform itself somehow into a one-state solution. There's a difference between a one-state reality and one-state. One-state solution means Palestinians and Israelis agree that they will live under one state, one roof, living equally or whatever. That is not going to happen. Not in my lifetime. Not in the next 25 years. So for all of you fans of a one-state solution, if there are any among you, that isn't what will happen in the next 25 years. But there is a reality, however, that is called the one-state reality now. We all live, today in Haaretz, there is a report about how many people live in this area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. It says there are 12 million people who live there, and it says, these are figures from the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics. So they are not my invention or Haaretz's invention. 12 million people, it says, live in this area, and it says Jews in this area constitute 5.9 million people. So